I will call this meeting to order. We are going to go out of order on the agenda because not every board member is here to even vote on the minutes. So we're going to go right into call to the public. And I have a number of things to say to those who want to speak. Preference is going to be given to people who work hard enough to show up in person. We've already clustered comments by the topic. Then we'll move to online comments. The other thing you should know is that this is being recorded. It will be posted to the web. And if you have additional things to submit in writing or otherwise, that will become part of the permanent record. We want to make sure that we give everybody a voice who wants to speak, but we ask that you pay attention to the speaker who may be addressing your topic. If they are giving a fairly complete, in your view, representative of what you feel about a topic and you have nothing new to add, do us a favor and just say you support that person, and then we'll let somebody else speak if they have some differing kind of opinion. You need to speak up when you recognize and say your full name loud and clear. 5 minutes is allotted per speaker, and by law, the board is not going to act or respond to what you say. We cannot do that. Take everything under consideration, and we will talk about that at another meeting. Just so you keep your expectations within the expectations and within the law. Okay. I'm going to read this just in case you don't know. This is called to the public, and it's per the open meeting law. Consideration and discussion of comments from the public, those wishing to address the board, need not request permission in advance. The only reason we have to fill out the that form is to kind of group comments together, actually for more input. Members of the board may not discuss the items that are not on the agenda. Therefore, action taken as a result of public comment will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or schedule the matter for consideration or decision at a later date. So, with that in mind, welcome. Okay, just looking. Wow. Doug Hawking, Bruce Wynn, Greg Scott, John Lacey, yes, Tom Rose, they are board members. All right. Tom Foster is filming something. Maybe. Okay. But, I don't know if you missed. Can you hear me? Yes. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah. Quite well.
Yes. Okay. All right. We're going to start with the audience. They worked hardest to get here, and want to recognize that effort. So, already these are clustered into, not surprising, into certain kind of groups. Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, we should. Sorry. Robert, could you give us the roll call?
Hello, everyone. I think you can all hear me right. Okay. I'm going to be doing a roll call. For those of you that are on Zoom, please make sure to also take yourself on mute, take yourself off mute when you respond. To begin, Joe Abadili, Robert Ballard.
Here.
Lorna Brooks.
Here.
sworn out Brooks.
I am here. Hello.
Maybe it takes a while to get to you, Mom.
Here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Janice Bryson. Kelly Corsett.
I'm here, thank you.
Boy Coy. Tom Foster.
I'm here.
Bruce Gwynn. Doug Hawking.
I'm here, thanks.
Jeff Horwitz. John Lacey.
Here.
Tom Rose.
Here.
Fred Scott. Jim Snitzer.
Deadwood.
Okay. Marshall Trimble. Michael Wade. Linda Woodentaker.
Here. We'll take, should we just do the old minutes right now and then move on? That should be a quick up and down. These are minutes from actually June 19th, this is the last time we had a board meeting with these kinds of minutes. And I want to know if you've read them and if you have any changes or corrections for us. If not, can I have a motion to accept?
Move to accept the minutes.
We need a second. We have a second. Okay. Yep. Okay. Any opposed? Hearing none, we'll accept the minutes as they stand. We're now in the call to public, and I don't know if you were able to hear me before, but we're going to start with the audience. Some of them have traveled a great deal of distance in order to make comments. I want to recognize them first. We have an initial grouping by topic, and we'll do a by topic. We will do the audience first, then go to online. What we're asking is, if you've heard someone testify to your satisfaction and covered the topic, and you have nothing new to say, all you need to say, if you want to say anything at all, is I just support those speakers or whatever, so that we can move on. But if you have something different to say about that topic, we will recognize you. 5-minute limit. As I said before, this is being recorded, and we want you to announce your name loud and clear, so that that gets recorded as well. If you have something also in writing that you want submitted, that will also become part of the permanent record. Any questions? All right, we'll get right to it. This would not surprise anyone, but we have a cluster of issues that fall under the MOUs. So Fort Lowell, the Wells Fargo Museum downtown, and Reardon. And I am pleased to recognize Gwen or Charlotte, if they want to speak first. Go ahead. Yes. Take the mask off, actually, because we want to be able to hear you. You stand and just... No, it should be that one.
Is it?
Oh, yes. Okay. If you would, sure, come around here. We've got audiences in the back. We have audience in the front. And so if you,
the camera's there, though, correct?
Yeah. So that's the okay.
Okay. Are you watching my time? The timekeeper. Good afternoon. My name is Gwen Groth, and I am a volunteer at Reardon Mansion, member of the Arizona Historical Society, and third-generation native of Arizona. I care about our history, and I am heartsick to think Reardon Mansion will once again face uncertainty. I am also very worried for the Arizona Historical Society. I worry that we may see the end in 2023 when the next sunset moves down. I was there in 2013, as many of us were. The 2013 sunset review was not favorable. AHS did, however, show great promise and diligence when taking over operations at Reardon Mansion State Historic Park. During a non-COVID year, the average number of visitors to Reardon is well over 20,000. This far exceeds the numbers seen at the other AHS properties. While not a revenue generator for the AHS central money bucket, Reardon Mansion serves as a great way to market AHS by promoting memberships and visits to other sites. It might also be the reason we passed the 2013 sunset review. After all, at the time, Reardon had more than 38% of all visitors to AHS museums. I am worried. According to the 2013 sunset review, Reardon Mansion was operating well in the black, and I quote, since the Society added this park to its operations in 2010, the Society's admissions revenues from its museums and the park have increased by approximately 270%. The most recent annual report published by AHS shows a total of 45,000 visitors. Letting Reardon go is going to take that number down by nearly half. The public views history from the heart, not from a financial aspect. The public and the state legislature will see AHS making a choice to discontinue operating a popular historic home and continuing operations of a museum in an expensive non-historic building with few visitors. The mission of AHS is connecting people through the power of Arizona's history. This recent proposal is doing the opposite. Dropping from 7 museums to 4 is not a good way to connect people with Arizona history. The Sunset Review stated that the Society should strengthen relationships with the private support groups. This surprise agenda item is damaging relationships, especially with the public at large. Having unlimited admission to Reardon Mansion as a membership perk is certainly helpful. I'm afraid that dropping this perk will lose additional membership. The Sunset Review points out concern with collections management. It seems the Tucson museums are also in the action item, and they have a great deal of AHS collections. The AHS website reads, and I quote, we fulfill our mission to connect people through the power of Arizona's history by collaborating with federal, state, and local governments, industry, school districts, and community organizations to strengthen Arizona's cultural infrastructure. This is exactly what these operational partnerships do. I'm very worried. Looking at the strategic plan posted on the AHS website, there are lofty goals for visitor numbers. How will we meet those without Reardon? I am also surprised that the strategic plan does not mention staff retention or satisfaction. A successful organization needs to have happy employees. There are previous events that the public will remember that will be brought to the surface again with this proposal and after sunset review. The closing of the Mining and Mineral Museum and the failed Centennial Museum are still sore spots for many Arizonans. Whether or not AHS had any fault in these matters, many people will hold grudges and will add this to the list of grievances. Again, the public only sees what's on the surface. Rather than breaking partnerships down, perhaps it's time to think about building them up. Perhaps it's time for Arizona State Parks and Trails and the Arizona Historical Society to merge. The State Historic Preservation Office is already there, and many
states do this with great success. If you must do this, please do it with grace, respect, and careful discussion. I am concerned that this surprise agenda item is already a permanent bruise for AHS. Thank you.
We also have Janice Klein.
I'm going to try to be loud enough with the mask on. As many of you know, I can probably do that. I'm Janice Klein, the Executive Director of the Museum Association of Arizona, and the board has put together this statement for you. The Museum Association of Arizona understands and sympathizes with the financial challenges faced by the Arizona Historical Society, which are shared by museums across Arizona and the entire country. However, we wish to express our concern over the proposed unilateral termination of longstanding collaboration partnerships with the City of Tucson, Wells Fargo Bank, and the Arizona State Parks regarding the operation of historic Fort Lowell, the Downtown History Museum, and Reardon Mansion, respectively. As I'm sure all of you know, each of these museums provides a unique perspective on Arizona history, so I will just add the briefest of comments. Historic Fort Lowell contributes to the military history of the Southwest, including the role of indigenous people, both as allies and adversaries, and is integral to the Fort Lowell Historic District, which includes several buildings on the National Register of Historic Places. The Downtown History Museum provides a full picture of the growth of Tucson, including its Spanish origins, and in the words of one visitor, is an honest history museum that actually covers early Tucson history, not only the American history that is done by many historical societies. The staff and volunteers of Reardon Mansion have worked closely with the Arizona Historical Society's Pioneer Museum to develop both the award-winning Todos Unidos exhibit as well as the current groundbreaking exhibit, Resilience, Women in Flagstaff Past and Present, which has served to unite the many disparate cultural organizations in Flagstaff. Rather than voting today to dissolve the relationship with these three partners, the Museum Association of Arizona urges the Arizona Historical Society's board to direct the staff to enter into discussions with each partner to determine how the Arizona Historical Society financial burden might be mitigated and in developing plans for the future of these valuable museums. To preemptively terminate the existing memoranda of understanding without these discussions would put the museum's missions and collections in jeopardy to the long-term detriment of Arizona history.
Thank you. And I have your written comment. Joe Meehan.
This is on. My name is Joe Meehan. I'm from Flagstaff. I'm here on behalf of both Reardon Mansion and Fort Lowell and the Downtown Museum in Tucson. I had this very long written statement, and Glenn just shot it out of the water, all of my points. So I do agree with all of hers, but there are a few things I would like to include. When you talk about divesting yourself, doing whatever to these museums, I think you need to look at more than just dollars. You need to look at the people in those communities. You need to look at the community support that Reardon Mansion has had from the Flagstaff area, nationally and internationally, people who come, and we have found that people come from Europe and other places to view the architecture and the collections of Stickley furniture. There is a lot of it. There are a lot of activities that go on at Reardon that are supported very strongly by the local community. The same thing in Tucson. With the Wells Fargo Museum, you have the small community in the downtown area. That is there community history. That is their identity. And especially at Fort Lowell, you have the Fort Lowell neighborhood community that comes out every year and supports the Fort Lowell Days and feels very strongly about the activities that go on there during that time. And as was pointed out, it is a museum not just of military history, but it is a museum of all of the interactions between indigenous people and the United States. I think before you start looking at getting rid of museums, getting rid of these facilities, look at the long-term range of what is going to happen when COVID ends and you have no place to go back to. You don't have these facilities to open up, to continue the interpretation and the story of Flagstaff and Tucson. What do you do with when you don't have the historic sites where people actually live and you can't see the way they lived and people do not interact with pictures on a wall, letters in a book, and things like that. There's nothing more exciting, and I've seen it because I used to be a manager of here. I've seen it where children come in and they are astounded by the fact that they can actually walk through where the Reardons lived. They can see how the Reardons interacted with their community, and they can feel that connection with Arizona's past. So I ask you, please take a very serious look at what you're planning on doing. Thank you.
And Charlotte, do you have anything to add? Oh, please come.
Good afternoon. I'm Charlotte Madden, the president of the Northern Arizona Pioneer Historical Society, or NAPS. I am also representing the Reardon Action Network, or RAN. RAN is a grassroots organization dedicated to the preservation of Reardon Mansion State Historic Park. It was formed by a group of private citizens in 2009 when severe state-level budget cuts threatened the closure of the park. RAM promotes and raises funds on behalf of Reardon Mansion. It operates under the fiscal umbrella of NAPS, which is a 501c3 organization. In July 2010, the legislature cut the Arizona State Parks budget by 61%, in addition to sweeping the earmarked donations and foundation funds that the agency depended upon. Consequently, State Parks has forced to make very tough decisions about closing several parks, including Reardon Mansion. RAN ultimately raised $33,000, and in 2010, when the IGA was signed, RAN purchased the inventory of the Reardon gift shop from State Parks and helped cover other transfer costs. Almost immediately, RAN assisted with funds for a new roof. We funded an AmeriCorps position for several years to serve as the education coordinator, which has led to a full-time education position shared by both Reardon Mansion and Pioneer Museum, and it is partially grant-funded. Since 2014, RAND has contributed nearly $84,000 directly to support Reardon Mansion, including repairs, preservation, internships, operations, and supplies. NAPS has also supported the local marketing of events and lectures at Reardon Mansion, amounting to additional $7,200 per year. The amount of in-kind contributions made by our supporters is immeasurable. RAND continues to be successful in raising funds to support the mansion, but certainly not enough to cover continuing large deficit budget balances that AHS has reported since 2018. AHS reports show that for a number of years, Reardon Mansion ran well in the black, and we are proud of the support we gave to make this happen. In April 2014, Reardon had a fund balance of $63,400, and the busy season had not yet begun. We know that costs have risen and that financial needs change, but we are also aware that budgets need to be discussed to ensure sustainability. Surely this park can be managed in the black again. Recently, we requested financial reports from AHS containing details. We found items charged to Reardon that did not make sense, including meals, lodging, and travel. It was promised that an adjustment would be made, which we appreciate, as they are not operating expenditures that donors would be happy to support. Additionally, the use of expensive temporary employees also raised the cost to operate Reardon. Arizona State Parks has been a tremendous financial partner in providing maintenance funding, and we do thank them for that. In fiscal years 2018 to 2020, they have provided $400,000 of in-kind support, including new fire and security alarm and sprinkler systems, a new roof, electrical upgrades, a new front porch, balcony repairs, and safety upgrades, to name just a few. We were shocked and blindsided when we learned that the agenda today contains a recommendation from your executive committee to cease operations of three museums. Each of these properties is unique, and a withdrawal of AHS support will have different consequences for each one. The groups I represent are respectfully asking that you step aside, consider each museum separately, and allow time to have full discussions with the partners to make decisions that would be beneficial to all concerned. To be frank, we don't care who operates Reardon Mansion, as long as it is an organization that values history and works with transparency and community support. Thank you.
So, do we go to online now? Jane, do we go online now? Same topic.
Can you all hear me?
Yeah, can you just tell her, like, we have a new ball, so we don't really have a process for how to do this. I'll just have to put in the chat box who wants to talk and go.
Sorry for the interruption. So, okay. Do you guys know where to look on a chat box for Zoom? You know where to look, because you could Jay's going to recognize people on this topic through the chat box. So take a look at what appears in the margin, I think on the right-hand side of your screen.
Yeah, I can see it. I'm watching it.
Okay. Okay, who do you want to recognize? Okay, we're talking about the three MOUs and the three new museums. Who would like to speak or might have something to add or say about that? Okay, Demian. Where art thou?
Hello, I'm Damian Plinko. Thank you very much. The mute button was difficult to unmute. I'm Damian Plinko. I'm a former member of the Arizona State Legislature, and I currently serve in elected office as the chairman of Pima Community College. Today, I'm here in my role as executive director of the Tucson Historic Preservation Foundation. After receiving notification yesterday regarding this meeting and the recent executive committee's recommendation regarding the termination of the MOUs of the three museums across the state, two of which are located in Tucson specifically, we sent a letter on behalf of PHPF and our thousands of members across Tucson and southern Arizona outlining our very deep concerns about this alarming action contemplated by the board today. Our concerns are particularly focused on the total lack of stakeholder engagement, which was made clear already by the speakers that we've heard from today. We've heard the term, you know, surprise, you know, stealth, because frankly there has been no stakeholder engagement. We received an email response from the chair of this board, Linda Whitaker, claiming a satisfactory public stakeholder engagement process has occurred. This is a misrepresentation at best and a total lie at worst. The effort to ram these changes through is disgraceful, and it reflects Ms. Whitaker's total lack of community stewardship and poor leadership of this body. The taxpayers of Pima County passed a bond issue to invest millions of dollars into the expansion of Fort Will Park and restoration of cultural resources there. This was clearly in part to the museum's partnership and their location to be able to provide meaningful interpretation of the site. But yet, this is being held in the middle of a pandemic, quietly being pushed through without any notice to the public. The neighborhood surrounding this museum was notified in the last 48 hours only. At the minimum, moving forward, a stakeholder engagement process needs to be developed to draw in local experts to explore public-private partnerships. If the Arizona Historical Society can no longer manage these resources, then there needs to be a path to find new leadership to help run them. And I think it's an opportunity for a renewal of partnership and to reinvigorate these spaces with new types of community engagement and partnership. The proposal and recommendation by the executive committee is quite frankly, it's a disgrace. So I'd like to ask that the board table this item and direct instead a process to create partnerships that find solutions to keep the intent of these museums going instead of unilateral action that harms the cultural fabric of our community and our state.
Next. James? Is it
Frank?
Frank Flash next? Or do you have anything to add, Mr. Flash?
Yes, Frank is being asked on mute.
Yes, this is Frank Flash. I'm from the Old Fort Lowell Neighborhood Association, and Damien said it best. We're extremely disappointed in getting short notice concerning this decision. We would welcome working with AHS to come up with some solutions here, but we were notified in such short notice that it doesn't give us much hope for doing something. However, I want to support everything that Damien said, and I think this item should be withheld right now, so that we can have those type of discussions to move forward. We all want to keep the museum. It's an integral part of the Fort Lowell historic area. We highlight it on our Fort Lowell Day in February, and we work closely with the museum on an ongoing basis to make sure that it's well-received in the area. So I'm extremely disappointed, as is the Neighborhood Association, to get such short notice without having any chance other than this format to talk about it, and let's see what we can do with a public-private setup to keep these museums going. Thank you.
Ken Scoville. Mr. Scoville. We cannot hear you. You need to unmute. That's it.
You hear me?
Now we do.
Oh, good. I want to totally agree with everything that Damien said about the issues of a lack of timeliness with actual notification, let alone the trouble with the process. I do want to add a little different perspective that I clarified a little bit in the letter I said yesterday. But I'm a retired teacher and a historian and guide around Tucson's historic areas. I've given hundreds of tours over 35 years for adults and school groups. And both facilities, both museums in downtown, provide invaluable interpretation that is only available. And that doing a walking tour and using these facilities provides just an intensive level of interpretation that's not available anywhere else. We have starved so much about this state. Education has just become an embarrassment to me as someone that's been in public education for 30 years. This needs to be worked out with meetings. There's lots of support for these museums in Tucson. We just need notification in the process. Thank you.
Does Barry Spicer want to talk? Add something, Barry? Unmute.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, board members, for this opportunity to speak in favor of your retaining the operation of the Fort Lowell Museum. My name is Barry Spicer. I live in the historic El Fuerte part of the old Fort Lowell neighborhood. I have lived here on and off for the last 75 years since 1946. Museums have been important and influential for me since I first realized that my father had an office in the basement of the Arizona State Museum. Since the time I learned to read, the text associated with the displays in that museum provided me with many fascinating and educational hours as I learned about the origins of the Holcomb potsherds I had seen in the adobe walls of the ruins of Fort Lowell. What I learned at the State Museum about Holcomb communities, Apache people, and the U.S. Army provided impetus and backdrops for my wanderings on foot and in history books, as well as my entry into scouting through ceremonies in World War II barracks that had been relocated to Fort Lowell. Given this background, imagine my excitement at the restoration of Cottonwood Lane and the officers' quarters with the installation of the new Fort Lowell Museum. Eventually, as Dave Faust, the new curator, developed additional displays, I learned more about the role of the cavalry and Apache Indian scouts in southern Arizona, among other Fort Lowell-related topics. The Fort Lowell Museum provides an opportunity for tangible links to the past of the Fort Lowell neighborhood, the city of Tucson, and the Tucson Basin, as well as the heritage of southern Arizona and the greater Southwest. It is a vital part of the identity and, along with the chapels of El Fuerte, one of the anchors of our neighborhood community and with one another. In conclusion, I would like to say that as a community anchor and our link with the past, the Fort Lowell Museum is, in so many ways, not only one of the gems of the old Fort Lowell neighborhood, but of the city and region also. As such, please try to find a way to continue its operation, even if it has to be delayed until the threat of the coronavirus pandemic is controlled. Thank you.
Representative Chino is next.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Fantastic. Good afternoon, President Whitaker, members of the board. My name is Andres Cano, and I represent Legislative District 3 in the Arizona House of Representatives. That includes the downtown area of the university, the west side, and the south side. This morning, I was alerted to your meeting today as a member of the legislature and also certainly as a stakeholder with a vested interest in protecting not only the Downtown History Museum, and the historical Lowell Museum. I just found it absolutely a backwards process to say that this was on the meeting minute and we've discussed it and enough public input has already proceeded. I hope that I can add my voice today for you, President Whitaker, to consider a delay of the action that you are considering today along with the board. I think the stakeholder process is one that I support where you engage folks because ultimately these are tough decisions and don't think for one second that I or the others on this call expressing their concern about this vote are not wanting to be collaborative or engaged with you on discussing the long-term successes of these groups. These are tough, unprecedented times, but our history and our culture is timeless and it's resilient, and I know that we will overcome this pandemic together. And I look forward to supporting you, President Whitaker, and anything you need with the Historical Society to get your legislature supportive of where we're going to go. I know more often than not we are not a collaborative partner, and in this particular case, I want to be. So if there's anything I can do to be supportive and encouraging your postponing of this, I'm adding my voice to my Southern Arizona constituency to say that government should do better and be better, and I expect that of this group today. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Sarah Marsham.
Hi, I'm Sarah Marsham. I'm a Heritage Resource Consultant based in Columbus, Ohio, but I am a Northern Arizona graduate, 2010, with a degree in Parks and Rec. I received this degree thanks in part to an internship at Reardon Mansion, and I've gone on to receive national awards from the National Trust for Historic Preservation for my work in historic preservation, which I do largely attribute to this experience with Reardon Mansion. The lack of community engagement and awareness for this potential disconnect of these sites across the state is very disconcerting. While I agree that museums across the country and world are experiencing some financial hardships at this time, I think that if AHS wants to consider ending these memorandums, that it is integral that they create a plan that sets these sites up for success and not for a potential closure. We need to be creative in how we do our community engagement. And when I look around at all these screens, I don't see many faces that look like me. I don't see many young faces. We are telling these, saving these sites and telling these stories for our next generations of Arizonans and people beyond. It is integral that these sites stay open to varying degrees of capacity and that AHS makes sure that we set up these sites for success, whether they stay attached or they're on their own.
Thank you, Sarah. We have the director of parks on the phone, and he's the next one up.
Linda, the issue with this is that we have 67 people identified only by phone number, and I have no way to know how to unmute him. Short of unmuting everyone and asking that everyone else please behave in the meantime while Director Brosi speaks.
Let's try that, because he's an important voice.
So, testing.
Bob, can you hear me? Are you there?
Although some people need to be mindful what their backgrounds are when they Zoom. Because do I really want to see your bedroom?
Okay. This is going to take a minute. We will find him. But if there's anyone else who wants to speak on this topic, it's going to take a minute.
We can go ahead and have anyone who wants to speak next to address the MOUs. Any location? Anywhere? So bear with us as we unmute, I don't know, 60 plus people.
Okay. Right now, everyone's unmuted.
Okay. Bob, can you hear me? Executive Director of Parks, can you hear me? Can you tell if...
The phone number that he says he's called in from, we cannot identify in the participant list.
Okay. Maybe that will come up. If we have exhausted that particular topic, all will become a matter of record. I'm going to go to the next topic. It is going to be flags, markers, monuments. We have two speakers for that. So either Jacob or Dennis.
Good afternoon. My name is Jacob Rayford. I am the Director of Communications for the Rising Project. Essentially, we're here to get rid of monuments that are here for the Confederacy or support the Confederacy. We would like to relocate them to museums. However, we feel it would be better to monumentalize people or movements that support a diverse Arizona. So they say art represents life. Art is life. They say monuments are art. They say art is a snapshot of a point in history. So when you look at specific monuments, you look at a period of time where people affected by that, who aren't necessarily represented by these monuments, they may have experienced oppression, they may have experienced chattel slavery, they may have experienced the dismantling of their communities, of their political opportunities. So in this diverse time frame that we're in of 2020, we would like something that represents and that is emblematic of an Arizona that preaches inclusivity, that preaches a more diverse outlet or outlook of Arizona as a whole, something that's emblematic of the diversity of the state that we live in. That is the beauty of art that preaches and pushes for love. So we have ideas on how to remove the remaining Confederate monuments and replace them with something that represents the Latino or the Black or the Native or the LGBTQ community, because these underrepresented communities make up the rich tapestry of Arizona, of the state that we call home. So we would like to continue to put attention on these monuments and recognize that when certain people say that this is heritage and not hate, that's because they live outside of the demographic that was targeted by the monuments that basically honored specific individuals long before this state was accepted in 1912. So we have plans to create murals and art projects that represent these communities, and would like to present them as we continue to keep the subjects in the national spotlight, because that's what we're doing as an organization with the Rising Project. So I'm going to keep it short and sweet. Arizona is a state that houses many different backgrounds and walks of life and races and religions, and we need art that is representative of that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Dennis, do you have something different to add? You're okay. All right. Oh, Dennis. Okay, sorry. My apologies. Okay, Dennis, would you like to speak? I keep calling you Dennis.
Hello everyone, my name is Dennis Alamparo. I am an AHS member. I'm a freelance web developer and a chemical engineer. I'm originally from Yuma, Arizona, but I've been living in Tempe for the past 11 years. So I just want to say first and foremost, I am in support of removing from any Confederate monuments or flags from public spaces and having them shown instead in museum settings. You know, I heard about the Confederate flag removal at the Tucson Museum and wanted to say that its removal was appropriate, as it was just hung up without any educational story attached to it. To argue that it stayed up without any museum presentation of it is silly. Let's not forget that this is a symbol that is representative of slavery, hate, and divisiveness. Now, I know now that it is an important time to reexamine this period of American history, given everything that's going on with today's society. I think with the thoughtfulness, consideration of the museum, you should present such symbols and monuments in a thoughtful and careful setting. And I believe the museum should be the ones to house these symbols and markers. With that being said, just thank you for your time, and I really appreciate you guys having these kinds of forums, especially now given the climate that we're in. So I look forward to being a lifelong AHS member from here on out. Thank you.
Thank you. So, James, at least from the floor, I don't see any additional topics here. However, let me just, if there's, there are all kinds of things one can talk about. There was a whole list kind of checked off. Is there anybody who wants to speak to a different topic before we move on to the people who are online? Anybody? Okay. Yes, there's a Tiffany.
Yes, hi. I wanted to speak to you about the contemporary exhibitions that they have at the Arizona Heritage Center. So is that a topic that's being discussed?
Exhibits are on the list, so go ahead.
Am I okay? Okay, great. Just to give you all a background about me, I'm a second-generation Arizona native. My grandparents moved here in the 1940s from Chicago. My mom was born here, and I was born at St. Joe's as well. I'm also chief curator at Mesa Contemporary Arts at Mesa Art Center. And so I have worked quite a bit with this institution as well as other sister institutions. I actually recently did a site visit to the Arizona Heritage Center because we're looking at our own reopening plans. And so they were very courteous and let me see the exhibition that they have there, their contemporary exhibition. So I wanted to go into a little bit of information that I wanted to talk about. For me, it's important to balance our history here in Arizona with contemporary relevance. The Historical Society needs to represent Arizona's past as well as our present and future. The largest display that I've seen at the Arizona Heritage Center is like a time capsule of outdated attitudes and thinking. And for me, it reflects basically my parents and my grandparents' generation. It reflects some of my childhood. And of course, I grew up. You know, I no longer look back with nostalgia and have a hard time seeing its relevance in my life today. So for me, the contemporary supplemental exhibitions are an important part of rectifying Arizona relics with our current living history. And this is a tremendous problem I hear from other communities, especially local indigenous communities, where our historical museums have a tendency to represent them as relics of the past rather than current existing cultures. So when I learned about the Still Marching exhibition, that was really my interest was piqued because I saw myself in that exhibition. And so much of our history, Arizona history and also American history, has been so focused on white male exceptionalism that it was actually really something to aspire to see like things like, you know, talking about we have two female senators right now. This is an important, significant milestone. I mean, of course, I grew up knowing about Rose Mofford and some of our significant leaders in our culture, but that exhibition was really nice to see it brought home. I've also participated in several of the women's marches, and actually the Smithsonian African American Museum is actively collecting posters from, like, different causes and movements now, like the Black Lives Matter. You know, they show, for example, Emmett Till's coffin. They talk about the history, but they also talk about how things relate today. You talk about how history, you know, repeats itself, but it also rhymes. So it's important for us to look at the past, but also look at the present. And I think the Arizona Historical Society needs to be doing the same thing, collecting contemporary collateral, you know, important things that are happening right now and preserving it for future storytelling. And I kind of wanted to make a little comment about the monuments. Being an Arizona native, it was, I mean, granted, I grew up in the school district. I went to ASU. I mean, Arizona at the time was 48. Now we're 50th in education, so maybe my education is a little lacking, but the significance of the Confederacy in Arizona was really not that big. Never understood why those are even relevant here in Arizona. I mean, the biggest battle happened at Picacho Peak, and it happened even before our state became, you know, before we became a state. It was become the Arizona Territory. So for me, the relevance of them being relocated to a museum makes a lot of sense. I'd rather see that than them destroyed, personally. And talking about, you know, the context of that history. I think it's important for us to listen to those communities, the intentions of why certain things were put together, put on display in such a prominent place when it's really something that the Confederacy was only 4 years. I mean, look at the Women's March. That's been around for 4 years. So that's just as significant if you're looking at that as a significant part of American history. So anyways, I just want to say that I appreciate you guys all considering this, but and my part of my history here in Arizona, I visited the museum, and these contemporary examples really help make it a little bit more relevant to what we're talking about today. And people like me, like another person that talks about their age group, I'm not a boomer. I'm an Xer. My generation just doesn't relate to this. So thank you so much.
Your time is up. The next person up would be Jim McPherson. Jim?
Hello there. That mute button is always tricky. Hi, this is Jim McPherson, a volunteer board president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation, our statewide historic preservation organization. And briefly, I'd like to talk about two topics. One is about Confederate monuments, and our board has taken a stance in opposition to Confederate monuments on public property, on state public property. Being put in a museum with context is fine. For example, the presentation that was the Arizona Historical Society just had on Zoom on the education of the Confederate monuments and our Civil War history was very informative. That's education. But monuments is a different thing. Secondly, on the issue, and I'm sorry, I'll put in the chat box our online sign-on letter asking the governor to seek the removal of the one remaining monument on state property down in Sierra Vista. Regarding the MOUs, we appreciate all the comments that have been made by our friends and colleagues in Flagstaff and Tucson about the importance of their historic resources in their communities. And I would, as with the board, urge a tabling of that topic and a sincere engagement process be undertaken with your partners, with your stakeholders, with legislative officials to really come up with some solutions as opposed to what's being proposed right now. Thank you.
Brenda Thompson.
Hey, I can hear you. I hope you can hear me.
I can.
Thank you for letting me speak. I'm Brenda Thompson, and I'm the Executive Director of Arizona Humanities. I hope folks are familiar with us. We're the Arizona chapter of the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm also an AFS member personally, and also our institution has a membership. So I'll speak primarily in my institutional capacity, but I wanted to point out that by being associated with Arizona Humanities, it means I've had the good fortune to work with many of the museums that people are representing here across the state, and the Arizona Historical Society personally for the past decade. And of course, that seems like a short period of time when I look at my predecessors, Dan Schilling and Julie Yoder and Lorraine Frank, because they worked with you since 1974. I wanted to actually speak on the issue of whether their exhibits should reflect recent trends and the social and cultural transformations that are taking place. And I want to high-five both Sarah Barson and Tiffany Farrell because what they spoke of touched my heart and spoke right to the issue of what is actually happening, not just here, but across the country. And I wanted to speak specifically about the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the need for cultural institutions to serve everybody. And I want to be clear when I'm speaking that even though I happen to be a black chick, I'm speaking for everybody. I'm speaking for all people, not just for me. And that is because that is the job that I do. I'm speaking for human beings. And when we provide grants to organizations across the state, it's for everybody. And when you're thinking about the future of AAHS, I think it's really important to reflect on what is happening nationally. I'm actually serving for the first time on the board of the Federation of State Humanities Councils, and that organization represents all of the councils all 56 states and the Virgin Islands, Guam, Rica, Samoa, and we represent the councils to the nation, to Congress, and also we work with the National Endowment for the Humanities, and so we report to Congress. And we have the pleasure of hearing the chairman of the National Endowment speak about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I wanted to tell you that he made it very clear that the NEH cares about the integrity and the cultural competence of the leaders of these institutions. He spoke about that at great length. And the reason it's important is because the NEH provides $150 million to museums and cultural organizations across the United States every year. And one of the things he talked about was how it is a national priority. And so I wanted you to know that that Federation board that I'm serving on, we don't just snap our fingers and get smart about this. We are learning. We are engaging professionals to teach us. We know that it's an ongoing process. And so the Federation board and staff are engaging professionals to make sure that we're culturally competent in the administration of our duties. And I hope that this board will consider this. I know it's tough at a time of tight resources, but there are a lot of different ways to learn about how to serve people across the state. I also want to make sure that when you're thinking about it, you think about it the way that we do here at Arizona Humanities. You ask ourselves, does the leadership, our board and our staff, reflect the diversity of the people we serve? Do we have leading business professionals, civic and local leaders, tribal leaders, nonprofit and for-profit? Do they have financial management, fundraising, marketing, foundation, governance skills? The reason is because we need smart people to address these situations and be able to pivot to serve the communities that we have to serve, which are very diverse. The last thing I wanted to speak about is just this virtual world that we find ourselves in. And to underscore to you what I'm hearing and seeing nationally from all these different museums, from all these different humanities councils who are re-envisioning how they put programs on. They are doing this feverishly, daily, passionately, and using all of the resources that are available to them, but also learning from each other. And I want to particularly point out that AHS is part of this trend. I know that it's easy to focus sometimes on the challenges, but I want to point out some things that they're doing great, and I think Tiffany touched on this with the Marching Still exhibit. Even this summer, when this crisis was just breaking, the Arizona Humanities, Arizona Heritage Society put on a virtual history day. And with maybe 2 weeks' notice, they did a virtual conference, and 600 people participated. That is unprecedented. I have been working on conference panels, and to put together something that quickly in a virtual format and have it be well received, my hat's off to the staff. That was a phenomenal undertaking, and I know this for working on similar events myself. I also wanted to comment that even before that happened, AHS was already updating its AV equipment, its podcasting equipment, so that the Women's Hall of Fame event was the best that I had seen, attracted the largest group that I had seen, was one of the most professional, and that was the one that happened a year ago. Cindy McCain was one of the honorees, and so I see that continuing.
Brenda, your time is up, unfortunately.
I just have one last thing I want to say, if I may, and that is just a personal call to action, and that is really the one that Tiffany touched when she was talking, and so I have to tell you this. This is all, these conversations that we're having are about listening and learning. And I know that we can get stuck at times on signs and symbols and monuments, but I want you to understand that history does not live in things. History lives in the hearts and minds of people. And no matter how different we are from one another, we have two things in common. Our humanity, our basic humanity as people, and our destiny. We have really important work to do here, more important now than ever, but how we treat each other every day matters. And when I say we, I mean all of us. We, the people of the United States, we, the people of Arizona, we, the people of Phoenix, we, the people that we are serving through these museums. And when we say we, These are the stories of everyone that we are connecting, and that the work that we are doing is so important. So please keep this in mind and remember that what museums do is help us remember the past and reimagine the future. And it takes a lot of different people to do that who are very diverse. So thank you for listening. Thank you for letting me go over time. And thank you, Tiffany and Sarah, for helping to share different perspectives from different generations with me. And thank you to the members of this community and this board.
We are going to have the Director of Parks next, coming to you by microphone and iPhone.
Can you hear me okay?
You can hear him. Okay. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, you can hear me.
Yes, we can.
All right. I apologize for the lack of technological experience here. So, James, thank you for letting me use your cell phone. I'll make this relatively quick. I've been through many of those meetings myself. So, I wanted to speak to you guys today, and I appreciate the opportunity and the indulgence here. As you know, Parks and the Historical Society have been partners in managing Virgin Edge for many years, going all the way back to 2010, following the Great Recession. We are grateful for that. We're really grateful for the relationship that we have, along with AHS, RAND, and the many others that have helped keep Reardon operating through these times. Just so the board may or may not be aware, on June 30th, we signed a letter with staff and the director, deputy director, on an agreement to negotiate a new management agreement. This was really our old one was expiring. We've been kind of on a three-year cycle for amending those agreements. This is the time for Reardon. We signed that on June 30th with the intent to negotiate that new agreement for managing Reardon. I also want to let you know that the COVID-19 pandemic has been hard on all of us, especially those parks that have that historical purpose where physical distancing measures limit that visitation. We are fully aware of the financial impacts of not having that visitation, even at our own historical parks. So we do understand what the board is talking about. However, our historical parks, we believe in working with the Department of Health Services, have been able to reopen those on limited capacity. And I do understand Reardon and many of our other partner parks have remained closed as of today, I believe. We too, I think a lot of folks were really caught off guard by this proposed action. I was notified August 2nd once your executive committee minutes were published. And I received that from staff. But nevertheless, Reardon Mansion is a special place and is a valuable asset to all the people that spoke to it before, but to the state and to the Flagstaff community as a whole. It has touched many lives and careers. I just want to let you know we remain willing and able and with the full intent to work with the Historical Society on the management of Reardon Mansion. Through this new agreement that we may have and are quite open to restructuring that agreement for the benefit of all and for the long-term management of Reardon Mansion. I also want to let you know, too, as we do kind of hold the partner parks under our wing, we still own them, we still are working with our partners, to let you know there are many individuals and organizations. We heard from legislator Gannon before and many others that are working hard to ensure that our partner parks remain in the fiscal impact discussion of COVID-19, and we continue on that road today, and hopefully that will bear fruit here in the near future. And finally, the last point, just like you guys as AHS came to the rescue in 2010 with the closure or potential closure of those parks. It was a crisis. I remember it dearly. And when Heritage Fund was swept and the many other funds that had been swept, those were tough times. And we reached it and had an opportunity, and that opportunity was seized by AHS. I also believe COVID-19, they are tough times, but I also believe they are significant opportunities for together to make us even stronger as we come out of this COVID-19 pandemic. So, Madam President, thank you all, and thank you to the board for your time and indulgence in getting me to provide these comments. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Next, might be a few minutes before you get up there. Sean M.
Hi. I am.
Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. My name is Sean Morton. I'm an investment banker with experience in institutional finance, and I've also started a firm called LeadingWithEquity.com, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the monuments and the plaques and the flag. You know, education to the public on history is so vital at this moment. It always has been. And it's important that we represent even those most painful parts, right? But it's also our responsibility to discard objects that continue to exalt and glorify white supremacy. It's also our obligation to not continue to pay tribute to a government that was unrecognized, whose founding principle was the perpetuation of slavery. It's our collective duty to not honor and perpetuate those values of unabashed supremacy, slavery, lynching over the humanity of Black people and by extension ourselves, right? By extension, everyone, right? And I say this as a biracial Black and white man, right? We must reject these and challenge these symbols as part of our path towards being a peaceful, united, and prosperous country. You know, if we go and look at this historically, the Confederates built an explicitly white supremacist, close pro-slavery, anti-democratic nation state that was dedicated to the principle that not all men are created equal. Emboldened by what they saw as the failure of emancipation in other parts of the world, buoyed by the new science of race, and convinced that the American vision of the people who had been terribly betrayed, they sought the kind of future for human slavery and conservative Republican government that was no longer possible within the United States. This is the cause that those statues and flags honor. So I'm calling on the board today to basically say, when is it time to change, right? When is it time to acknowledge that we can talk about those past relics? We can talk about the harm that they've included. We can talk about the state of the nation then in an educational way, but not in one where we're just holding up knickknacks of a very short-lived, anti-democratic, pro-slavery, unequal state. And I would ask that we take into account the education and the awareness that we're all responsible, each of us as Americans, to have, to realize that it's okay to move forward, that it's okay to assess and say, you know what, this was problematic at this time, and we can talk about it in these new ways. We can talk about it with the deference, with the respect, but also with the realness of the impact that it had back then and today. Because if there's anyone on this board who does not believe for a second that there is a link between what we've seen in these monuments and these plaques and the racism that we see on a daily basis that are experienced by people of color on the daily, then clearly that education needs to happen faster. This is urgent for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Is there anyone, I think Dr. Thibault, the our last speaker, anybody before?
Oops.
Thibault.
Here
we go.
Please.
Yeah, thank you so much. Chairman Whitaker and board members, I represent the Public History Committee and History Faculty at Arizona State University and the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies, as well as our students. As we've watched and begun partnering with the Historical Society over the last 2 years, we want to rise in support of the present board and staff at the Arizona Historical Society for their excellence, their professionalism, and the way that they're expanding dialogue, making them more professional, inclusive, and diverse. The Whistling Dixie is an example of that. I'll comment in a second on the Confederate monuments debate, but I want to echo for a moment Brenda's thoughts about all the things that the Historical Society is doing exquisitely well in support of its mission. I'll speak only for a moment about the things we've been doing with more than 100 students in the Arizona Historical Society. The Arizona Historical Society emerged in March as a partner with us in creating the Journal of a Plague Year, an archive of COVID-19. We are working with the Historical Society to collect Arizona stories for what has become the largest digital archive globally. We're probably the most important archive of the pandemic anywhere in the world, with partners throughout the globe. The Arizona Historical Society recognized the importance of this work and has joined us in doing it. The Arizona Historical Society has worked with our students to build the framework for Arizona stories for an international traveling exhibit called The Climate of Inequality. The Arizona Historical Society and the Journal of Arizona History has worked with my graduate students to develop about 8 or 10 histories of monuments that will be in the journal, including one about the Confederate monument at Tecumseh Peak that I'll talk about in a second. The Historical Society is working with Banner Health to document that neighborhood and the history of the hospital. This is this kind of work that is at the very core of what state historical societies do and what makes this organization more effective. Our community recognizes the extraordinary value, especially over the last 2 years, that the Historical Society is bringing to our community, and it's becoming a leader, not just regionally, but we believe nationally in the field. We're proud to be a partner with the Historical Society. We also recognize that fact-based historical debate can be difficult for folks who will hold on to long debunked historical myths, myths debunked by a generation of scholars. The Confederate monuments debate was over. The history of the Civil War was over for historians in the 1990s when we worked with the National Park Service to reinterpret battlefields across the country to recognize that slavery, not state rights or some mythic lost cause, was the true reason for the Civil War. The American Historical Association, in terms of the monuments debate, has stated it eloquently. It's concluded that to remove such monuments is neither to change history nor to erase it. What changes with removal is that what American communities decide is worthy of civic honor. It's also true that monuments are replaced, moved, changed, torn down all the time across the world. They're not history. They're propaganda. They tell us what some people believe at particular moments in time. The Tecumseh Peak Memorial in particular began its life in 1928 as a monument to Union dead. People, American soldiers fighting for democracy, for the right of all Americans not to be held in shadow. In the 1950s, the United Daughters of the Confederacy, in support of its broader white supremacist agenda, which included terrorizing black Americans, takes over the monument and declares it a Confederate monument. That is changing the past, and it is destroying treasonous men and women, destroying, desecrating a historical site to the Union dead. Chris Bradley, our student Chris Bradley and colleague, writes about this eloquently in an essay that will be in the Journal of Arizona History. And included in this story is a short, is that the Historical Society itself in the 80s reinvigorated the Southern interpretation. That was wrong. We would ask, as historians, that history be considered. This isn't a case of heritage. This is a case of desecration. Secondly, as a citizen of Arizona and of the United States, I reject absolutely that we elevate traitors above heroes. It's an emotional debate. It's a hard moment for all of us. But we need to have dialogue, and I would commend the Arizona Historical Society for its Whistling Dixie dialogue. That is how we advance public conversation, and it represents the best of what this historical society is doing.
Thank you, Mark. Do we have Michael Amundson? Michael?
Yes. Hi, this is Michael Amundson. I'm a history professor at Northern Arizona University and the public history director for our history program. And I would just like to support the work that's being done with Reardon Mansion. Reardon Mansion and Pioneer Museum offer a seamless experience for our public history students. We have interns that work, and they're able to go back and forth, and it's just such a valuable opportunity for them to work both in a museum at Pioneer, but also to work in a house museum, which is something that nobody's really talked about yet. That Reardon Mansion is a great example of a local house museum, which is a very different kind of experience for public history. And to be able to have our students go back and forth between the museum setting and the house museum setting is really, really extraordinary. And we just really would like to keep that, and I just support its continued health as well. So that's basically it. Thank you.
Anybody else? This will be a last call for public comment on anything you want to comment on before we get to our last two speakers. Vicki Schrager and Linda Head. They have a presentation and some things to say. Anything before that? And we'll finish up then with Vicki and with Linda. Vicki, you might want to go first. You're going to have to unmute.
I think Linda's going to go first. Can we just take a couple minutes stretch? I think would help us in our presentation, might help all of you, like a minute to stand up.
And we have to bring up your presentation on the screen.
Yes.
How about, are we up for about a 10-minute break? Less? 10 minutes.
My suggestion, what is your preference? Do you want to begin or...
It's up to you.
I'm ready to go because I think it's I don't want to lose anybody, and it's important to me.
Okay, because I thought it would be better if everybody's fresh because we have some important things to say, so different perspective. Unless you don't think they're all coming back because they have a board meeting afterwards.
I'm ready to go.
All right.
Okay.
Is Linda, are people there or did they take a break already?
Are still here. Okay.
Okay. Go ahead, Linda.
Thank you. I just want to begin by saying my name is Linda Head, and I've been a member of the Southern Arizona Chapter Board and the AHS State Board, and I'm currently a member of the Friends of Arizona History Nonprofit in Southern Arizona Board. I'm a volunteer in the archives at our museum, and I've been in the museum volunteering at least one day every week for the last 9 years. I speak to you today with the support of the Southern Chapter Board, Friends of Arizona History Board, and Los Amigos Board. These three support groups represent all of the volunteers of the Arizona History Museum, and we deeply care for the history of our museum. And I'm talking to you today on a different topic that we're jumping to the condition of exhibits in our museum, but it's not far off of some of the things that have been said earlier. And by the way, thank you, Damon Klinko, for your comments. Our museum has been rapidly deteriorating over the past 2 years. The decline in visitation, membership, and support for the Arizona History Museum is really not primarily a result of the construction around the museum or the COVID virus. It's taken a very sharp spiral downward over the past 2 years. During this past 2 years, there's been over, and I'm being liberal, over an 80% turnover of employees at our museum, and that should say something. Today, I want you to see what has become of our museum. And up on the screen right now are comments about the future of museums and what they should be doing in to really bring ourselves up to speed in the 21st century. And no doubt we all need and want to do that. So next slide, please. Before you do the next slide, can you go back 1 minute? I want to point out, what draws a person, this is Smithsonian, what draws a person to visit an exhibition as opposed to staying home and watching television programs about the topic or going online to study the topic? How is an exhibition a unique medium, an experience people cannot get other places? These are the three principles of museum exhibitions that are universal to all. The main business of exhibitions is to tell a story with things. Okay, let's go to the next slide, please. These are examples of the kinds of exhibits that we've had in the past, and I'm not suggesting we don't want to modernize and we don't want to bring everything up to present. We can do those in well-crafted exhibits. This is one that had been done in the past. Next slide. This is another one. We have a tremendous old mining museum exhibit that could be modernized by bringing it up to date. Next slide. This is one of our volunteers who's going to take a group of students into an 1870s experience that is there actually as they walk around. Next slide. These are our new exhibits. This is History 101 exhibit. And here it is. This is what our new exhibits look like. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. This is our Keeping Cool exhibit. It's talking about the history of trying to stay cool in Arizona. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. In order to get to those exhibits, you had to walk through this gallery that you're going to see. And this is what it looked like when our members were invited to come for a pre-opening when we tried to reopen in June or July, I can't remember which, and this is what they saw. Next slide. Next slide. These were taken then. These are this is the introduction to indicators of excellence with exhibits by the American Alliance of Museums. Next slide. There's a whole list of these, and all of the board members have received a packet that will have all these in there should you want to take a look. Next slide. This is the one important thing. It comes from Smithsonian. The main business of exhibitions is to tell a story with things. Whether artifacts, images, or original documents, there is an intrinsic power in seeing the real thing. There's also great appeal in seeing something rare, an artifact, a photograph that you cannot see anywhere else. The selection of things you display is very important. The objects and the images help tell the story. Next slide. Again, these are the characteristics. You can read them for yourself. Next slide. Okay, we're going to go back through these exhibits based on the characteristics of good exhibits by AAM and Smithsonian. Next slide. Okay, this is the picture I want you to look at. The criteria is the main business of exhibitions is to tell a story with things. Next slide. An aspect of this, of the exhibition design, is innovative. Next slide. The exhibition synthesizes and presents existing knowledge and or collection materials in a surprising or provocative way. Next slide. The exhibition includes innovative uses of media, materials, and other design elements. Next slide. The exhibition offers a new perspective or new insight on a topic. The exhibition presents new information. Next slide. Okay, and then you can rate these two exhibits based on that criteria. And you can, and we're not going to do this today, but you have seen the pictures of these exhibits. You can do that yourself. I want to end by saying I have been in much smaller museums all over the U.S. and the world that are more creative, inspiring, and interesting exhibits than these two new exhibits. These two exhibits are the direct result of lack of professional training and expertise of those creating them, and also the lack of concern or interest in our museum by AHS. And by the way, that kind of is the theme that's gone throughout all of the comments, or many of the comments before. This will be the last time I will be addressing the board in any way. You've allowed this to happen. That makes us all in Southern Arizona sad. And that's the end of what I want to say.
Vicki? Yes, I'm going to take off. If you would like to go back and just pull up one of those slides, that would be good. Thank you all for being there and allowing us to speak. My name is Vicki Schwager. I'm the president of Los Amigos, which is the support group of Southern Chapter, and it's made up of all the volunteers. Our function is, just anyone. That's fine. Any one of those is good. Thank you. We raise money. We work in the museums. We give tours. We help in collections, exhibits, archives, and with community events. We want to support and promote the Arizona and Southern Arizona history. We believe that the past can be more than 50 or 60 years ago, and our past brings current events into focus. This is a 10-minute presentation, but it's trying to explain to you 2 years of changes. Words, policies, and board actions have made Arizona History Museum and the Southern District, and now Fort Lowell and downtown museums, irrelevant. In the words of Dr. Burns in the Journal of Arizona History, of spring of 2019, the Journal of American History is broader, or Arizona History is broader in magnitude than the work that AHS performs at its brick and mortar sites. On June 11th, Dr. Burns continues, we have served more members in the public virtually than we were ever able to do on-ground facilities. Operating in the digital sphere has resulted in a focus on what we do with what we have, artifacts, archival materials, and less on the physicality of things we hold interest in for those who came before us. As you've been sitting here for the last hour and a half, you recognize that sitting and learning history online is not the ideal thing. The AHS current mission statement from 2019 to 2024 says our museums are spaces that foster critical thinking, encourage civil discourse, and promote thoughtful debate. Now, it's possible that the exhibits that you're looking at do just that. As a museum guide and as president of Los Amigos, I have been proud that our membership has been framed in objective interpretation. Many of us love to do research, we love history, and we believe its lessons can help guide our future. We believe it should be, exhibits should be energizing, engaging, and exciting. They need to be accessible to adults and children and people with disabilities. We even have toured the blind. While online exhibits and activities and journal readings are an important part of the Historical Society, we cannot lose sight of the importance of the museum experience, especially when they conform to the accreditation standards. They are important experiences in the lives of people who come to visit. I have watched as a group of children from the reservation school who had come to the museum picked up some of the instruments in the 1870s exhibits and began to sing in their native language. I toured a father and son who came to the museum and saw the John Slaughter exhibit. They were surprised, and they were happy, and they told me they were relatives. I saw a man photographing a gun in our Geronimo exhibit. I asked him about it, and he proceeded to tell me about how valuable it was, how the numbers matched, and how he came to the museum because of our gun collection. A tour with a mother and a daughter who went through our mining exhibit and asked how accurate it was. And then she happened upon a picture of a busy group of miners and recognized among them a relative.
We are a little bit over your time, so could we wrap up?
Okay. In Southern Arizona, our history extends beyond the current Arizona borders. We are the only city in the United States to be designated the UNESCO City of Gastronomy because we have 4,000 years of cultivation. These new exhibits are a perfect reflection of the direction of the 5-year plan of AHS. They replace objects with words and objective views with word panels promoting civil discourse and thoughtful debate, less on the physicality of things. Those same things are our founders treasured and that our current supporters prize. On February 15th, the Vision Committee said, creation of strong core values, being customer-focused, touching hearts, building relationships, and becoming a premier historical educational institution in the state. Clearly, our strengths are in our dedicated people and in our immense collections. We all see tremendous opportunity for the organization going forward. This is 2020, and those themes never materialized at the Arizona History Museum and in Southern Arizona. And now we can add to that Fort Lowell and Downtown Museum. Thank you.
That should conclude our public comment. I don't see anyone else standing in line ready to speak. I appreciate everyone who did participate. We are going to have, we're going to take a 10-minute break. I'm going to come back and have our board meeting, and we'll continue with the agenda at that time. Thank you all for participating. Really appreciate it. Great time. Do we need to call for Tom Foster? Okay.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. I've been here.
Okay.
Thanks for asking.
Is Robert there? Robert Ballard.
Yes, I'm here, Linda.
Okay, thank you. We're going to resume our board meeting.
Linda?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. Lorna Brooks is trying to get back on. I think she's working with Tom.
She just confirmed that she's on.
Ah, good. Okay, thank you.
All right. So item 5 is a summary of current events. I think we had a summary of current events, and we don't need to go into any of the detail here, and I'm just going to, whatever time is allotted, I'm just going to pass it on to the executive director.
Linda, this is Kelly.
Scott. Okay. All right. Okay, James, any time you want.
Hey, thank you, Linda. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. We realize that this month's 20-page report is a lot for everyone to digest. The staff spends a great deal of time analyzing data and compiling the narrative to give you a thorough summary of our activities. I ask you to please pay particular attention to our mission-driven activities relating to collecting, preserving, interpreting, and disseminating Arizona history. We've added partnerships to the report as they're key to audience engagement, making the organization more relevant, improving mission fulfillment, and better reflecting the interests of Arizona's diverse residents. Like thousands of arts and culture institutions across the country, AHS has been hard hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. The extended museum closures have resulted in a devastating loss of revenue from operations. These losses have compounded our already tenuous financial situation. AHS has reduced expenditures to the bare minimum, only the bills that need to be paid. In the words of a colleague at one of our peer organizations in the West, earned income is dead. Earned income was the lifeblood of AHS. In the booming economy of the past 2 years, staff continued to implement austerity measures while increasing earned income to new heights, nearly $1.5 million per year. Through those efforts, we built a reserve of non-allocated dollars, which is what sustains us at present, though that reserve is dwindling at the rate of more than $125,000 per month. The lack of earned income forces AHS to pay salaries, repairs, and utilities not covered by appropriated dollars from reserves. As just one example, we are at the point of being uncertain how to pay the monthly utility bills for some of our properties. Should we continue at this rate, the organization will be in a very precarious position at the end of this fiscal year. In short, we're immensely grateful for our state allocation and the financial assistance provided by numerous support groups over the years to help operate our museum. However, the support from partners and nonprofits, individual philanthropy, and the state, in addition to our previous earned income, still falls well short of covering operating costs. Like many institutions today, we are faced with extremely difficult decisions about our future. Staff is closely monitoring trends in philanthropic giving. Increasingly, AHS struggles to be competitive for grants or funding from family foundations for 2 reasons. Giving priorities are shifting to health and human services, and some are adding criteria, including inclusion and diversity measures. This evolution will affect the planned capital campaign as well as requests for annual giving. To receive funding in the future, AHS will need to evaluate and adapt its professional practices to be eligible for philanthropic giving from many sources. Membership declined for the first time during this pandemic, a dip of approximately 1% last month. While a downward trend is not something anyone wants to see, this figure should be placed into the context of what museums across the field are seeing in terms of membership right now. Most are reporting a membership loss of 30% or more. Our counterpart organization in Texas reported a membership loss of 47% yesterday. In comparison, AHS's ability to keep its membership relatively constant during the recession is nothing short of remarkable, and credit goes to our outreach coordinator, Shelley. AHS continues to enhance its digital presence. The Arizona Department of Education recognized AHS's Digital History Hub as a valuable resource for teachers teaching Arizona history materials to use in their online teaching. Our digital programming continues to increase in popularity. Recently, a program opportunity arose on short notice, and with only 1 week of virtual advertising, we had over 130 people sign up. Many were new to AHS. A soft ask in the registration resulted in about 10% of registrants making a voluntary contribution. We've also begun to see a trickle of new members who are able to identify, we can identify them as participants from our virtual programming. Since the written report was circulated, I attended a virtual gathering of state historical administrators who run our counterpart sites across the nation.
That window into the museum field, particularly organizations just like ours, is particularly illuminating. The highlights include, across the nation, state historical organizations are being called up to be responsive to their community, to engage in rapid response collecting and preserving both COVID-19 and social movements, to address their institutional history, and to be at the center of conversations about markers, monuments, memorials, and symbols in public spaces. There's a new appreciation for the role of history and a readiness to have a reckoning with the past. At the same time, budget constraints are hampering the ability of museums to respond at a time when we're most needed. Private museums, particularly those without endowments, are faring far worse than those who are state agencies or quasi-state agencies. As tough as our financial circumstances are, we're better positioned than probably 75% of our peers. That being said, even organizations that have some governmental funding are facing a precipice, similar to AHS. None know how they will be able to operate at their current level beyond next June. The directors of these organizations are engaging their boards in discussions about substantial downsizing. Historic houses and structures are particularly hard hit, as we've heard today. They tend to have cramped, confined spaces that do not allow for social distancing. Few historic structures have even tried to reopen. Those who have are reporting a trickle of their former attendance, as the public is not comfortable being in confined spaces at this time. In conclusion, museums are all struggling to develop plans to reopen as safely as possible. All are reporting a drop of more than 90% in earned income. Organizations that rely on very large gatherings of people, such as facility rentals, as an income stream, are facing much uncertainty and are beginning to survey their audiences to determine when or if they would feel comfortable participating in a large group setting. AHS's largest revenue source was facility rentals. That revenue stream will not rebound anytime soon, if ever. Thank you, President Whitaker.
Okay. Any questions for James? Any comments? Go ahead.
Yes.
In light of everything you study and everything you know, I'm going to get some recommendations.
I don't think it's my place to make that recommendation, Joe. What it is my place to do is to let the AHS Board of Directors know what the consequences of delaying these decisions will be. And that is, next July, we will be broke. That's correct, sir. I think that's fair, Joe. We can give you the breakdowns when we get to that part of the discussion in the agenda about what each site is costing us per month. I can tell you, though, overall that right now, as I said in my report, we are hemorrhaging about $125,000 a month.
He's losing money,
right? Yes, sir.
Okay, I think you've answered my questions. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Nothing else for James? I'm sort of back me there. Anybody else have a question up there? None? We'll continue on. We're going to talk about our board health. And Kelly Perstad, are you there? Kelly.
I am.
Okay. If you could just the election we had recently, we got some statistics in, and at our executive committee meeting, we talked a bit about the election processes, the results, the nomination process, and recommendations and so forth. And there is Kelly Forstack,
Tom Foster and Robert Ballard are looking at that. They maybe, Kelly, can give us a little bit of a glimpse of where you're going and when you think you might have a proposal ready for board review.
Thank you, Linda, and members of the board, and also members of the public who are with us. We have started exploring how we might improve the process through which the board officers are nominated and selected. That is something that that we're researching now, and we will get together here as a small team in the next week or so and develop some recommendations. And I think those will be ready for the September board meeting. I also considered whether or not it is a bit strange for those members of the public who are with us and don't know this, that the per state law, the entire membership of a death elects the office. And that's a bit problematic.
Kelly, we're losing some of your audio.
Okay. I'm sorry. Better now?
Better.
Okay. So per state law, the entire membership elects the officers. We explored whether or not it would be worth approaching the legislature about changing that law for a number of reasons that I won't go into now, but decided that that is not an advisable course of action. So instead, we are going to spend our time working on how we could improve our process as a board so that the next election of board officers can proceed more smoothly and with more transparency for our members. Thank you.
Any questions for Kelly and his group? Michael, any questions from your end? Okay. Next, board priorities and goals. They're part of your package. They don't differ from anything that I stated earlier. And if you have any questions about that, I'm happy to answer them. But they're part of your packet. And if there's any discussion, disagreement about board priorities, this is the time to speak up and tell me. Well, hearing none, I'm just going to assume, yes, go ahead. Yes.
My question is, at what point could we amend or add items to the board priority list?
As needed, as we progress through. These are very relatively short-term goals, not long-term.
Right.
We're just, you know, barely can keep our eyes on the horizon. So this is just what we think we can do in the next fiscal year.
Because what I'm thinking is, as we've seen today, it's going to be more and more important to foster positive relationships with the communities, the chapters, the support groups. So that's an item I think we'd want to explore for one of the top board priorities.
That is all that's ongoing and behind the scenes. So it's not being ignored at all.
But the more you can put it listed as a priority, the more it's going to get the attention of the board.
Linda, may I add one thing? Michael, that's a very good point. And so Linda has asked that I circulate these if approved, along with the executive director priorities that we established together. And then we should probably review those on perhaps a monthly basis at the executive committee.
We're tracking it fairly close.
History, like beauty, is in the eyes of the beholder. And if you paid attention to what everybody was saying, you would see all the different perspectives of what they think is appropriate to present in displays, in narratives, and presentations of history. And I understand and I respect all that. And everything that everybody said is correct. It seems to me, and I'm just going to say it, I'll say it now and I'll probably say it down the road again when we start running into these continued problems, we're going to have to sit down, maybe you need to have a special committee to sit down and determine what are the issues, the ideas, the history, the incidents, the people throughout the history relating to our mission that we want to make sure we can include. And so that we don't spend one whole year just doing it on the Arizona 1880s history or black history or women's history or Chicano history. And this is really the crux of what I heard today with all these different talks. Everybody has a dog in the fight. Everybody wants to see their dog win. And I understand that. And I respect that. But we can't be all things to all people all the time. And that, it seems to me, to be our biggest challenge if we're going to survive. We have some people who want to talk about different issues that mean a lot to them. I understand that. But that may not mean as much to other people as it does to them. And hence, therein lies the rub. So you got the message. You're smart enough to understand everything I said. I'm not so sure everybody else here is, but I know you are.
Oh.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Yes, history is personal. Very personal. Okay. There's a couple things I want to update you regarding the board. We know from the governor's office, probably thanks to all the lobbying you did earlier, maybe it's going to appear to fruition, but we may have as many as 4 to 6 people well along in the vetting process that the governor may be ready to approve. And we're waiting on that. They come from all over the state, and we'll just see what happens. I don't know their names, but they have gone through the fingerprinting process, and if you've gotten to the fingerprinting, you're at the end of the vetting that needs to be done. So we're close. Bring you up to date is, maybe you don't know this, I just learned this myself, is Bill Garbarino resigned from the board. And that is a loss, as is Len Marsh's. But having said that, the 4 or 6 people in the wings would cover those positions, if appointed. Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. In terms of committees, I have asked I've asked Doug Hawking if he would serve on collections, and he has graciously said yes, and Greg Scott has welcomed him as a partner. And Finance Committee, we are looking at 4 people from around the state with expertise in finance, nonprofit, banking, et cetera, to serve as consultants on the Finance Committee. Right now, the Finance Committee has a new chair in Jim Snitzer, and he's gotten several kind of orientations, but it is a steep learning curve, and he needs assistance, and he will get it. I see finance as being revitalized and increasingly very, very important to the functioning of this board. Okay, then I think we're going to go right on to the treasurer's report, and it will. And so this will involve both Jim and Bill Ponder and Jim. We are on item 8. Sure. No, we'll wait until we get to see. They're very distinct and very different. Okay, money. Treasurer's report. And this happens to us every year where we have to approve the financial statements that from June and July, but also approval of the new budget, the budget from for the next fiscal year. Those were put in your packets. Some of it is very dense material. But Bill, do you have anything to point out either in the June 2020, July 2020 financial statements? Anything there, big outliers?
We're going to let Kim take those as she's the principal who produced them.
Okay. Is Kim up there?
Kim? Kim
has to let her in. Okay. Hang on. Okay. Okay. Any outliers in the monthly report? Anything there we should pay strict attention to?
I think the things that we want to try to point out was that there, for last fiscal year, ending in June, at the appropriated revenues fulfilled themselves. We got exactly what was appropriated to us at the beginning of the year. By February, by the end of February of this year, this fiscal year, last fiscal year, we were $94,000 ahead in our earned income. So we were having a really strong year for earned income. And obviously February is when everything went into the tank. So for the last 3 months of that fiscal year, we basically were in the red by $87,000. So there was a swing of $193,000 of lost income from the earned income categories. That's just, the capitalization of how quickly those revenues turn south, those are the revenues where, because we're not open, those revenue streams are not coming back until we're open and open at a strong enough position where they can have some impact. What we tried to do with that is because we did have some vacancy savings, we tried to balance that out. And so overall for that fiscal year, we weren't down quite as much as we might have been, but the projected picture is not a pretty one. So the first month of this fiscal year, the month of July, all of our revenues other than appropriation are under budget. None of them have met the goals. So as a unit, they're down almost $24,000. And expenditures for that same time period are over budget by over $30,000. And that's only going to continue. And so this fiscal year, we're going to end up basically to have any type of programming whatsoever, we're going to be in living off the fund balance in our income categories. And so that's going to be a strain. I think James mentioned earlier, by the end of this fiscal year, if it continues at the pace it is, then we will probably, we will definitely not have enough to make it through the following fiscal year.
We have a motion to approve the financials for the month of June and July. A motion to, okay. Boyd has moved. We have a second. Michael Wade seconds. And all those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. All right. Do you have anything to point out for the proposed budget for 21-22?
So you all have in your pack the sheet that titled Arizona Historical Society total assets overall revenues budget request by 21-22. And we have been working with folks out of the Office of Strategic Planning and Budget following their guidelines for where we need to be for this upcoming fiscal year. And they, at this point, they have indicated to us that even with the strain on the state's finances due to all the ongoing activities, primarily responding to the COVID-related activities, they have not lost or gone into deficit as much as they anticipated. The rainy day fund was very strong in last fiscal year, and that has allowed them to continue to fund at the level that they anticipated. And so at this point in time, they are steady in their commitment to fund our appropriations at the level that was projected in the governor's budget. So there's no decrease for us at this point in time. What we have in your budget is, in your budget proposal, is, and actually the appropriated dollars make up about 60-70% of our budget. And so that portion of the budget will remain intact, and we have put forth that in order. Let me back up just half a second. One of the things that they have said that is important to them, and they have asked us to do the same, is try to do everything they can to protect jobs, protect people and their salaries. And so the last thing they're looking at, last thing they want us to look at, is the termination, layoffs, furloughs of employees. And so that's what we've done. We have continued to include what would amount to a budget that was similar to last year, using the fund balance categories of our earned income. And so that's what you see projected in here.
Any, yes,
Bill, are we going to have enough money to be able to deal with the City of Tucson, Wells Fargo, Arizona State Parks and Trails, and the operational aspects of the existing MOUs for Reardon, Mansion State Park, Downtown History Museum, and Historic Fort Lowell? Do we have enough money to deal with those?
Those would be extremely problematic.
So that's not a yes or no. That means there's a problem.
There is a problem. There is a problem. We are in the red with all of those.
We're in the red right now.
We're in the red right now.
Do you have any reason to believe we're going to get out of the red?
Not under the current circumstances. We are engaging in conversations with all of those entities. But at this point, we have no reason to believe that we have a solution in front of us, from our perspective.
Okay, because I saw that next on the list there,
And when we talk come to that, I want to make sure when we're talking about doing projects and doing things that we do, that we can afford them. You don't have a strong feeling that we're going to be able to afford these and make them operational. Is that a fair statement? Am I putting you on the spot on that? Let me rephrase.
Well, I'm extremely concerned. I don't think at this point that without some very strong injections of fiscal resources.
Fairy Godfather or Fairy Godmother come in and give us.
They can come from a number of sources, but they're right at this point. They're not on our horizon.
Okay. Thank you.
Linda, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. This message is for all 57 participants that are joining by telephone. We desperately need to be able to unmute board members who are on the phone. I'm going to unmute everyone. It's the only way to do this. I am begging you, if you are not a board member and you are on the telephone, please mute yourself.
Need a motion to approve the proposed budget. And when does this go before the legislature? Or will you have to get this in?
Our requirement is to get it in by September 1st. It won't go before the legislature until they're back in session. Between September 1st and the open of legislative session, we will work with the Office of Strategic Planning and Budget to meet whatever requirements they have in place. So that they can present the governor's agenda.
September 1st. So, can I have a motion that approves the proposed budget? Janice? Janice moves. Do I have a second? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Linda? Linda?
Yes?
Okay. We need to be very specific about getting the votes of all board members on the telephone. So I am going to call your name if you're a board member, either type in the chat or use your audio to vote which way you want to vote. Robert Ballard.
Aye.
Lorna Brooks. Lorna, you can text your answer to me if you cannot unmute yourself. Kelly Corsett.
Aye.
Tom Foster.
Aye.
Doug Hawking.
Aye.
Don Lacey. Don Lacey.
I gave you a thumbs up, James.
Is that a yes, John?
Yes.
Tom Rose.
Yes.
Greg Scott.
Aye.
And Bruce Quinn. Bruce, you're on mute. You have the ability to unmute yourself. Bruce, give us a thumb. All right, perfect. We got it, Bruce. Thank you very much. Okay, Linda.
My question is closed. Aye.
And Lorna Burford texted us an aye as well.
Okay. Did you get, did you need a recorded vote down here too, right?
Yeah. Did we have any no's? Okay.
All right. So let's go see. There's lots to be said about C. So, Roy, you wanted at the front end to make a motion.
With all the discussion this morning, and there seems to be some real confusion about delivery of the information to various entities that are involved along with the parts, and with all due respect to Mr. Ponder's job of trying to keep us from going broke, I think that I would like to make a motion to table this item until November, and to request that some of the information concerning the finances, such as the discrepancies between what Gwen was talking about with Reardon and in the last 2 years, that we need that information before we can really make a decision on what needs to go on.
We have no meeting scheduled for November. It's October.
I know, but I want it on November. I'll make it October. And with that, I would like to break out each one of those items on the agenda for October to be voted on separately, because there's too much difference between them than to lump them all together.
Yeah. Linda?
Yes.
Tom Foster, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Tom.
All right. If you want to call for a second, I will go ahead and second that with Boy. There's so much on the line here, even though financially it's so dangerous at this point, but I really think that Boy has an answer here, or at least an idea. So I would second that when you call for it.
Yes, there is discussion.
Table motion, if you check with Robert Sewer's order, it's not to be discussed, it's to be voted on.
Okay, so,
Mr. Lacey, is that correct or not?
That is correct.
Okay, Linda, do you want me to start the vote on the phone? Somebody needs to state the motion very specifically.
Okay, so the motion is to table under the treasurer's report and to table it until our next board meeting in October.
And the further part of the motion was that each of those specific items would be discussed separately.
Okay, John Lacey, need your help. Joe Abadili wants to table the motion. Can he do that at this point? We have voted, but...
The motion to table that was made by Mr. Coy was that the action on the three museums be tabled until the next meeting, and that his further clarification of his motion was that any action on the three museums be addressed separately. It was that motion to table that was seconded.
Do I have any right to challenge that motion?
I don't think so.
Okay, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Motion.
I'm running against myself. I think you're right.
Yes, we haven't voted yet, and we need to vote.
That is correct. That is correct.
You need to vote. Okay, so do you want to go by phone first, and then we'll go in the audience? James?
Yes, we're going to have to, we've got a little glitch here. Bruce wants to speak. He's going to have to call my cell phone so we can hold him up to the mic again. So, Bruce, you'll go last, but for the purposes of the... Motion
hey, James,
yep.
Look, I think maybe Bruce is waving.
No. Okay. No. We lost Bruce. Okay, so, Robert?
Up or down?
I vote yes.
Okay, Lorna. She'll have to text me. Kelly.
Yes.
Tom Foster.
Yes.
Doug Hopping.
Yes.
John Lacey.
Yes.
Greg Scott.
Yes.
And Bruce, you can just give me a thumbs up or down. Okay. That's a yes. You can go ahead to the audience now, Linda.
Okay. Roy, okay. How did you leave?
No.
And Whitaker, yes. That want to read the motion? Let me read that, Tom, if you get it. Okay. Then, John, okay, so that passed. This has been tabled, but there's some... Does that mean no more discussion either, or to? Okay. We're done. Okay? We're done.
Yeah, it will require a motion to untable or to remove it from the table. At the
next. Not doing that. Not doing that. Yeah.
No, what I'm saying is at the next meeting, the process there is to remove the motion from the table.
Formal motion to remove, and then... Okay.
And then we proceed with the discussion.
Got it. All right. Okay, next, we're going to talk about the sunset review and the performance audit. That report is part of your packet. What we need is approval by the board for the addition of the AAM Code of Ethics. As we discussed in the executive committee, this augments what we have already for volunteers and for staff, primarily aimed there, and it is in a format and language that AAM wants to see. Normally, this would be part of our records because you can't get approved in the first place without it, but we could not locate that original document. That's why you see it here. So, I don't know if you've had a chance to go through this or not, but the executive committee unanimously approved. It is one of those routine documents that needs to be there, and like I said, normally, it wasn't in our records, so we would have to review this, but we could not locate the original. So can I have a motion to approve, accept the Volunteer Code of Ethics?
So moved.
Doug Hawking moved.
Doug Hawking, okay, moves to... first mover, and then second is Janice Bryson.
Okay, we'll do the online vote first.
Yes.
Robert Ballard.
Yes.
Juana, you can text me. Sally Forza.
Yes.
Tom Foster.
Yes.
Doug Hawking.
Yes.
Don Lacey.
Yes.
Tom Rose.
Yes.
Greg Scott.
Yes.
And Bruce, you can give me a thumbs up or down. All right. Thank you. And we just got Lorna's in, and she is a yes as well. You're a go ahead with the audience.
Okay, boy. Joe. Michael. Lorna. Jim. Yes to me as well. All yeses here. Yeah. Okay, this next issue is an interesting and provocative one, and that is update discussion regarding sunset review tracking in our meeting with the Auditor General's office about 2 weeks ago. First of all, you need to know that we've made significant progress, and they liked our tracking document, and they liked what they saw. And furthermore, this has been shared with the governor's office, JLDC, I don't know if there's any other entity, but this has been widely distributed, and the feedback has been very, very positive. So positive, as a matter of fact, that we may be a candidate for a short review, as opposed to the 18-month-long process before. And if we can make progress with a couple of other issues, maybe that would be a go. They were very, very supportive. The AG's office is willing to make a presentation to our board, which we want to do. And that is all a good thing. Two things you ought to know, however, and it's not going to go away, is collections, collection management, and the Connect boxes have been flagged staff. They have a long memory, and they asked specifically what our plans were about that material. We have some proposals to make about that material, but they see the Connect boxes out of there, and that that those collections tucked away in a safe and climate control. They know that it's a work in progress. The other interesting thing that came up, and one, it was very difficult to bring this up, but to gauge their concern about 1107 funds. 1107 funds came up in the previous sunset review. And they, at the time, under recommendations, said, why are you giving money to chapters when your own finances are not stable and you want to ask the state for more? They focused on the financial aspects of that. I don't know how much they care about other aspects of the chapters, but it came up also in a meeting about 15 months ago with Senator Farnsworth, specifically about 1107 funds. And they weighed in heavily at that time as well. We acknowledged that that was under discussion and for further discussion, but you need to know that people, that they are looking at it seriously, and I don't know if they're going to be, if they're going to move from recommendations to some sort of requirement. Some of their recommendations can be soft, some can be hard, but this appears to be hardening to me. James, you were there. Bill, you were there. Is that assessment fair? Do you have anything to add to that?
If what you've reported, Linda, reflects the tone and the tenor of what I heard.
So, it's just a heads up, it's very sensitive, but there it is. Yes.
I'm getting the impression the legislature is going to start tightening down, as you just said.
Yes.
And that is why I recommended it all the way I did on the previous issue. So let me ask you a straight up question, and if the staff can help you with that time. Can we afford to be operating the way we are right now?
Well, I'm coming down front, Joe, but I'll take that. That's a resounding no.
Bill, what do you think? Say no? Is that no?
And from what I know and the data that we've been presented with, and I have no reason to doubt those numbers, there's been a rumor circulating that the books have been cooked, that somehow the numbers have been faked, and these numbers are reviewed by a lot of people who only do numbers. And
you mean the allegation that our people cooked the books? Well,
and created this crisis.
you know,
we're really not in this kind of a situation.
We live in a capitalistic society. We're all used to buying things and selling things and all that other stuff. I also know that there are a lot of strong feelings on the historical things. There's a lot of stuff up in Flagstaff that's historical. There's strong feelings. A lot of stuff in Tucson. I'm from Tucson. That's historical. And we would love to keep those things going forever. But if we can't pay for them, and this is what I guess is going to happen. Boyd got the motion and he set the time. So the next time we come here, we're all going to figure out how to pay for all this. Or we're going to have this vote again. And I hope the people will use their brains and figure out if you can't pay for it, don't buy it.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment on the 1107 funds. I think that people need to realize that the 1107 funds are created by individual directives as part of additional contributions to their membership fees, and as such, I think we almost need to view those as directed funds, and that if we unilaterally change the use of those funds, you know, we may be violating a trust responsibility to the people that made those contributions.
And the legislature may not care, John.
Well, we may need to return those funds to the contributors too, Joe.
We're going to have to take a real hard look about how we've been spending money, how we've been taking money in, how many people we've tried to accommodate in order to keep the membership up. I understand all that. I respect all of that. But now the rubber has met the road, and we've got to figure out a way to do this. Boy, that's an interesting pointer. Or sell it. And I agree with that. But you just can't spend more than you take in. That's all I'm saying.
Well, the other thing is, just about the MOUs, remember, we don't own those properties. You know, we don't own them. Other people own them. So, in terms of selling off state property, maybe, John, you know more about selling state property than I do. Janice.
I just wanted to tell Joe that the reason I voted yes on Boyd's motion is because of the 48-hour notice, and we're waiting to see if the people, particularly at Fort Lowell and Reardon, can figure some kind of a partnership to help us out, and I think that's what we're kind of waiting on the vote, is not to just do nothing in between.
My response to be that is this starting now, just now? This is the first bill.
Just hang on. That is wrong. Yes, please.
Oh, yeah, okay. There's in here, there's a word that's really important, to direct the staff to act in a timely manner. The as much as anybody, I drove this, and my thinking was, the walls are closing in. Every month that we delay making decisions, the walls get closer and our flexibility is less and less and less. This decision will be made. But when it's finally made, like right now, I mean, theoretically, we could say, hey, the MOUs are canceled in 30 days. That was absolutely not the intention. The intention was to say, the MOUs are canceled, staff, go do your thing and work with these guys. Is there a way to perpetuate Reardon and Fort Lowell and Tucson? Is there a way to make them continue in existence? Will the community support them? And the idea, for example, if we said, oh, we're going to do away with Reardon, and the response from Flagstaff was, oh, okay, well, 30 days is plenty of time. If the response from Flagstaff was, no, we'll get together, people, our response would be, well, how long will that take you? You know, we'll give you a month or 2 months or whatever it takes, if you can get the community support. So the intention was never to just flip the switch and we're gone. The intention was to find a way that's sustainable for them, but sustainable for us too.
The problem, as I see it, though, is each of these entities has their own group of people they're dealing with. And Flagstaff, I think, is the most organized and has the best financial backing on it. If we were to drop them tomorrow, I think they all would survive and probably do better than the Arizona Historical Society. I could be wrong, but I think that. And they should, because they have a great operations going on up there. Some of these other little exhibits and all that can't do that. And the people that are helping them, Fort Lowell was born and raised in Tucson. I love Fort Lowell. I want to see Fort Lowell be reinstitutionalized as much as it can. But I don't think we should pay for it if the public around us doesn't want to support it. And that's where I'm coming from.
There's a Murphy's Law that says everything is connected to everything else. And we saw that today when people are saying, gee, I'd like more exhibits, better exhibits. I'd like to really pull out the stops and have every exhibit be exceptional. And boy, wouldn't we all like that.
Awesome.
But at the same time, we're saying, well, but we, you know, back when we used to have money, we were supporting all this stuff at some level. Well, the money's gone away. I mean, it's just gone. And so now we've got to decide what is it that we can support. Either we're going to do everything poorly, and we'll be known as the Everything Poorly organization, or we'll pick what we can do, what we do well, and build on those successes. So, you know, it's a real, I mean, that's why board of directors exist. I don't have the answer, but collectively we do.
I have another point to make about notifying or putting notices up in a timely manner. We are obligated to post minutes within 72 hours. And so on that July 22nd, when we had our very first executive committee, it has been up shortly thereafter and online. And it was a courtesy to then forward this on to the board so that you, even if you missed it online, you could get a feel for what we were doing and how we were doing it. Our agenda has been posted. So was there an obligation to talk to my neighbors, neighborhood associations? We have already talked to the city. We have spoken with Parks. It is not a surprise to Parks. They knew this was coming in some way, shape, or form. So for people to claim they weren't notified or personally notified, nope, they weren't personally notified, but phone calls were made to the owners of those properties. They knew what was being considered. So I don't want to hear about, you didn't tell us. Not true. Tom?
Yes.
You want to speak?
Well, I was just going to comment in reference to the 1107 funds that, and reinforce what Joan Lacey mentioned. The issue there has not been addressed more specifically. According to the latest that I have here on Sunset Audit, said that that had been completed in March of this last year of 2019. The issues with 1107 still remain there as to what they're being used for or whether they will be used or not. I do believe that the individual chapters should still have some control of the monies that are donated or given to the AHS by the members in their region and the members who specifically associate themselves with an individual chapter. That being said, the other issue is when you look at the 1107 fund, there's 60,000 aggregate according to the last financial report in those funds. That actually could help, but it is not going to do much but cut in half the hemorrhaging for 1 month. So I don't find it a significant dollar value to ease the overall budget. The issues that I do come up with is finding the proper, or having guidance to find the proper expenditures for those. There are several things that I've been considering in Northern as proposing, but until I find out whether it's suitable or allowable under the bylaws and the policy, I'm not going to make any of those proposals. But I still think that the chapter should, as it is only one of their two responsibilities, is chapter should have an 1107 fund to work with, and they should be able to spend that according to the state regulations. And we need to find the state regulations so that we know how to do that.
Let me add to that. The issue they find, when they look at the numbers, is that there are some chapters that routinely expend those funds every year. They're spending them for local projects. There are other chapters that have sat on that money, and it hasn't gone anywhere.
Right.
That bothers them. It just plain bothers them. So we don't have a uniform way of expending these, or some equitable sort of way, even locally. And they don't like to see that.
Yeah, one of the things that I could suggest is that we do need to work with chapters on the directorate level and the board level to get those funds expended for items that are suitable for use of those funds. Primarily what I've been told is that they're for display or improvement of displays within your chapter, or some sort of an improvement such as that. Now, that could be in Northern Arizona. It could be used as making additions or changes to some of the displays, which would include the Oney Park cabin's roof, or the interior repairs, or even applied toward porch repairs, because those, and if those don't come under the expenditure allowances, then we need to define exactly what they are and then make an effort to have each of the chapters that has those funds to spend them. Now, one thing that is noticeable is that there's an Eastern chapter but has no facility, so a facility fund just doesn't seem to work there.
The other thing is there must be some misunderstandings about how local boards can expend their funds. They have spent funds on other than exhibits. They have spent, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. In terms of how those funds can be used, the funds can be used for virtually any operating cost that or project that is approved, as long as that falls within the bounds of state statutes, and by and large most of the things that we do fall within that. And so the choice of whether or not the funds are spent on a project or an exhibit or utilities or or salaries is purely been made at the local level, but it can be similar.
So would you remind me,
what the process looks like and what three signatures are required for those expenditures?
Well, the way it was set up historically was that the expenditure of the fund required a sign off by the president of the local chapter and the staff member who was the liaison or director of that chapter and the finance director. So all three of those entities are in agreement, then it gets extended.
What happens if they're not?
Then it doesn't get extended.
Beg your pardon. According to the policy manual 9-4, the chapter requests expenditures and it requires a signature of a chapter president and currently stated appropriate division director. As currently set up, there is no division director, so that particular location there could be construed as to be anyone.
This bureaucracy would make Rome blush. I'm just curious, what do these chapters, do they have their own separate museums? Do they have? I know they have meetings. I know they spend money, because we just talked about them spending money. But are they really necessary other than for public relation purposes and to be able to have them become part of the overall historical society? Do they have individual meetings? Or, not meetings, museums? Why do they need all that much money? Are they making displays every week, every year, once a year, every 3 months? Does anybody ever ask that question?
Joe, speaking from Northern Arizona, we've spent that money pretty much down to a zero in the past or very close to it. We've used it to pay for the provision and installation of infrared or UV shielding on the windows to preserve our exhibits. We've used it for upgrading facilities, buying new display areas and displays so that we can exhibit some of our items.
You have museums there. Do all these other places like down south? John could probably answer this best. But in Pima County and all these other places, do they all have separate museums, or does this all go to the museum in Tucson? I mean, we are.
Let me answer that. The Southern Arizona chapter has always been, has historically been very active in the cooperation to promote and prepare exhibits, and the funds in the 1107 funds have been directed towards whatever the costs were associated with that museum.
You're talking about Tucson?
Yes.
And that organization, who would give them money and then they turn around and make exhibits for the Arizona Historical Society?
Sure. Because I think that their primary reason for existence is in support of that museum.
So we're giving money from the Arizona Historical Society to an outside organization to turn around and make exhibits for the Arizona Historical Society.
No, it's not an outside organization. It's part of the Arizona Historical Society.
Gentlemen, can I interrupt this for a minute here? We have Bruce Gwynn waiting in the wings here to talk.
You're good to go, Bruce. Bruce, you're muted on your end.
Hang on.
Right, he's contributing to somebody else. That's him.
sir, so I'm going to call you back.
I just want to, don't interrupt me, then you can, Tom, this is Linda, I just want to, I'm hoping that you get clarification on how we can spend that money locally. I mean, it's wide open. I've never heard it been fined just to exhibit.
Yeah, okay. We've got the word. Go ahead.
I just want to say, in response to Joe's question, you know, if I understand right, you pay $50, you're meant to pay $100, $50 comes back to the local deal. And that's how we sell it. It's a community involvement. It allows people to help spend money to help the local event. The local museum belongs to the state. However, it allows local people, your community, to get involved and become active with a minor effort in a local museum, which is part of the state museum. It's as simple as that. I don't know what's so difficult about that.
If I may, we really ought to be able to explain this to the state. Not the way Mr. Ponder does, but the fact that the money should be going right back into AHS. We're just encouraging local participation, which is bringing money in to AHS.
It's obvious to me we have not made the case with the AG's office about the functions of those chapters. They are not... We have things on paper. We have notes. We have studies. We have a bunch. They are still not convinced. That's all I can tell you. And even though you're right, Tom, it looks like on the Sunset Review that it is completed. It's completed because we left a lot of board meeting minutes and so forth. But in point of fact, we haven't solved it. We can move that can down the road. But that's ahead of us. And she thought today was hard? Yeah.
Process. I think John Lacey made an extremely good point about when people join, they're directing that the money go to a particular location. And what this is doing is using local pride to help the overall organization. And you can find different chapters that, for a variety of reasons, may not have spent all their money at a particular point. But I think that's all the more reason to get back with them and tell them about different items that we would need their support on. But what we've seen here today is clearly not a situation where you want to take money away from the chapters. It's really a case in which we need to use the chapters as a greater way of communicating with the local communities. And so I think there are, just as Doug Hawking noted, there are ways to describe this to the Auditor General's office, but it is more important than ever that we connect with the people of Arizona, because that's going to give us a greater ability to connect with the legislature and really reflect some of the individual community needs.
I have a question about just using membership funds in general as a way of getting money back to chapters. We have a real trend happening here, and that is more and more people not identifying locations. More and more people are not. So what about that?
Well, that goes just into the general AHS. It doesn't go to an individual chapter. And if that is the trend, then the level of seven money is going to be less sizable in the future.
It is.
But right now, this is a way in which, and you hear this often in northern Arizona, it is a way in which you can make a pitch for membership to note that a portion of that money is going to the local organization. Because in reality, there is a lot of local identity and loyalty in various communities.
Yes, the identity, there's an emotional component here that is very challenging to deal with. Lots of hurt feelings, lots of thank you, Joe. That is what's coloring a lot of this. And as someone pointed out, it isn't just the bottom line, it's the emotional component that is going to have to be dealt with in a different kind of way. And Jim Snitzer is, as mild-mannered a man that he is, he's tough. And I wish I'd given him more time. But he's right. We are going to have to make some very tough decisions here coming up. Can we move on? Is it okay to move on to announcements? I know we have some. Janice, did you want to announce a thing or two? And did Bill Cavalier, is he still up there? Maybe not.
I think he is, and he's probably, I'll let him explain more then, because Doug Hawking at our board meetings has explained to us about the battle between the Apaches and the Army at in Walker Canyon, the Chiricahua Pass battle. Two soldiers were killed, coincidentally born in Ireland. And I know the Cochise County Historical Society is working on having a marker put up. And Doug and I and Marshall Trimble came to Linda and the board and asked about a letter of support. So the Arizona Historical Society has written a letter in support of their project. And also, I'm going to ask the Irish Cultural Center to send a letter of support for that marker, too, and I'll let Bill explain more.
Is Bill still there? He was?
Yeah, Bill was here. Let me see. I watched him walk away from his desk. Give me a second, I'll get him on the phone. His line's busy. Bummer.
Well, the bottom line is we answered Bill's and Doug's and Janice's and Marshall Trimble's request. That letter's been written and is ready to go out in the mail.
And we thank you. And we're looking for other support down in southern Arizona, the Huachuca Museum Society, the Corral of the Westerners, and others. So thank you, AHS, for your support.
Any other announcements? If none, I declare adjournment.